Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
The writer Bill Gifford has a new book about heat, about how we have adapted to it. So he goes way back to when our ability to sweat gave early humans an edge. And he lays out the modern research, too, like how using heat is linked to lower risks of things like heart disease and Alzheimer's, how high heat seems to trigger these proteins in the body that help with cellular repair, how it might play a role in recovery and resilience. So the book is this mix of evolution and physiology and modern science, and it's all centered on this idea that heat isn't just something to avoid. It's something the body actually responds to in these really complex ways. And as you might expect, Gifford writes about saunas and how they show up in cultures all over the world. And so if you're going to write about saunas, naturally you have to go to Finland, which he did. And you're probably imagining some wooden hut on a lake, on the edge of the woods, covered in snow. Well, it's not quite how it happened. Gifford was in an industrial town not far from Helsinki.
It had these sort of old-school public sauna bathhouses, and one of them in particular was called Raaporti. It's like this unassuming building just off the bus line, not fancy. There's like weathered letters that just say sauna over the door. It's like $10. Sex segregated. Butt naked, out of my comfort zone, let's just say. And it was said to be legendary for the quality of its steam. And I really didn't know what that was about because the only sauna I'd really been to was the sauna in my health club, which had a sign saying, don't put water on the rocks. It wasn't particularly hot. Anyway, I met this nice guy, Alex Lemke, who kind of tends this ancient sauna and preserves its traditions and everything. He's in charge of lighting it up, heating it up every day, and I go there with him. And it's wood-fired, and it's got this tremendous big plaster-covered brick furnace with a raging fire and like a ton of stones that are just heated up for hours. You can just feel the heat, like it's masses of heat emanating from this thing. I cannot believe how hot it is. Like, I'm going to die. And then the door opens, and Alex is like, here come the blister boys. They like it really hot, like the hottest it can possibly be. So they're here when it opens. They climb up more and more and more, like we're squeezed in with all these people. And then finally, somebody says something in Finnish down below, and I hear the word Lola. Steam. Somebody pours, like, it sounds like a gallon of water into the furnace, into the stones, and you pour it deep down where they're, like, red hot. It's like apocalyptic. Lashing my back like 1,000 fiery needles. By the end of that day, I was a convert. I could never go back to the sauna in the gym with the sign that says, don't put water on the rocks. What I just described doesn't sound fun. But weirdly, this steam, this Lola, it becomes this like comforting thing. It becomes almost like this sensation that reminds you that you're alive.
You describe yourself as unclenching when you were there. There was something there. And I just wonder if in that moment, the idea of feeling alive, that is, if I don't get out of here, I can die, yet feeling that sense of pleasure, a kind of primal pleasure or something like that, is what the book's about in some way.
Yeah. And, you know, this all started in a kind of primal way. It was that winter we had here in Utah that was very snowy and very cold. And I was shoveling the car off every day, like Groundhog Day, and just started going to the sauna at the gym just because it was warm. I was like, okay, I'll try this out. And I just felt better afterwards, and I'd feel good. You know, heat is more and more relevant in our lives for various reasons, climate change being one of them. But also there is interesting data around its possible uses, therapeutic uses. So I thought, okay, I'm going to explore this and kind of lean into it a little bit. Try something I don't like, you know. I don't like weightlifting either, but I go to the gym. So let's try this and see what it does.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Bill Gifford is with us for the hour. His book is called Hotwired: How the Hidden Power of Heat Makes Us Stronger. And we started with something he mentions early on in the book. People have strong feelings about heat.
Well, as I've found, it's a little bit of a divisive topic. There are people who don't like it, like a sauna is the last thing that sounds appealing to them, or you know, there are people who avoid hot weather. And then there's always like the people you see out like riding their bike, you know, when it's like 100 degrees here. They're always like a little bit leathery looking and tough. And, you know, I was an amateur, very bad amateur mountain bike racer back in the day. And they're always like the toughest riders were the ones who thrived in those 100 degree, you know, humidity days. And they would just crush everybody.
They were out there in July and August.
Yeah. And they had this like heat tolerance built up, and they could just kill everybody. I was like, wow, that's cool.
You describe heat as this double-edged sword. It can, you know, it can hurt you. It can even kill you, but it can also heal you, and it can make you stronger, which we're going to break down those aspects here in a minute. But I wanted to have you say something about something you mentioned in the book early on, that there seems to be this natural sense of balance that our bodies feel about heat. You say we're hardwired to understand that the really extreme heat can kill you.
Yeah.
At the same time, we really like feeling warm. We, you know, you come out from the cold and you want to feel comfortably warm. So what's going on with that paradox as you understand it?
I think it goes back to the fact that, you know, we made this evolutionary trade-off where we, for various reasons, our ancestors lost all their body fur, right? Mm. So we're hairless, sweaty apes. Mm. So we actually do pretty well when it's hot. Cold is a bit of a struggle, actually. Cold actually kills many more people than heat.
I think some people may be surprised by that.
But yeah, that surprised me.
Yeah.
That was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think somewhere in our genetic memory, we associate warm places with survival. And then there's interesting suggestions that may actually be hardwired.
Yeah.
Like we associate warmth with emotional warmth.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about one of the sort of experiments that you did, I'll put it that way, and that is the Hotter'n Hell 100.
Hotter'n Hell 100.
Tell us about this. This is a crazy bike ride in Texas. First of all, explain to people what it is.
Yeah, so it's held every year in Wichita Falls, Texas, which you've probably never heard of. It's a small city, kind of a couple hours north of Dallas, and it was an old oil boom town. Like 100 years ago, that was kind of the peak. And they started doing this bike ride in August, I think to celebrate their 250th anniversary, something like that. And you'd think that sounds like a terrible idea, ride 100 miles in Texas in August. I mean, even if you're from Texas, that's a tough one, but it caught on. Thousands of people come every year to this event. It's a great event. There are medical tents, you know. You can get an IV. You can get a ride back to the finish if it's too much. So I signed up for this thing during that cold winter. I wanted to have like a challenge out there to see if some of the theoretical physiology that I was learning about heat adaptation, like how would that translate to a very ordinary athlete named Bill in practice? Like, could I do this? And so that was like the big challenge.
You wanted to feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. And see if it worked.
That you reached out to this exercise physiologist and heat expert named Robert Huggins. He's in the book. And he thought you were crazy for doing this.
Yeah, especially for doing the Hotter in Hell 100.
Because that's what I mean.
He'd
yes.
been there as part of research teams, and this event had been used as kind of like a laboratory, you know, to see what happens to people basically if you ride 164 kilometers in 100 degrees, and they tested all kinds of things like hydration and mental state and fatigue. And so he'd done studies and he'd seen people like falling apart at mile 86. He was like, are you sure you want to do that? Because that's pretty crazy. So then he agreed to kind of shepherd me, train me, test me, shepherd me through this training process.
This was the part where you write about kind of the origin of heat testing, and which originally comes from testing miners in South Africa.
Yeah. Men working in the gold mines were starting to like have trouble and die as the mines got hotter and deeper, you know, really terrible, extreme environment. And so this doctor who worked for the mine said, look, like not every black person is automatically heat tolerant. So we have to like, we're going to test these guys and see how they respond. And so basically the test is to like work, but in a heated tent, in a controlled environment, take their temperature. And the people who got up to a certain level in an hour, you know, if your temperature keeps going up, that's bad because then something bad is going to happen to you. Some people were okay and some people were kind of in between. And so they could kind of stratify the workers. And so this test I did was a direct descendant of
that.
You
did this test. This is the test you flunked.
Similar test, yeah. Completely flunked.
Yeah. We don't need to say too much about it, but the probe is quite exacting.
The probe is a rite of passage.
Yeah. The rectal probe.
They're not sticking a thermometer in your mouth.
Right.
They want your core temperature.
But you learned that you flunked the test, which told you what about the fact that people react quite differently. People have different tolerances, and we're not sure why they're different.
Yeah.
Do we?
Not fully.
Yeah.
No. I mean, a lot of it is exposure, but the results of my test confirmed the story that I'd told myself, which is that I'm a winter guy. Also, you know, I was pretty out of shape too, like not in the best shape. And that is related.
Yeah.
It's related, but they're not the same. So heat tolerance and fitness are they overlap, but they're not identical.
Well, I think it gets us to one of the stories of one of the people that you write about in the book, and this is a football player named Ryan Sobota.
Yeah.
And you tell the story about how he first of all, tell us what happens to him, because it's a sort of a terrifying story.
Yeah. He was a freshman football player, University of Virginia, and, you know, they start practice late July, early August, and, you know, because football – they make it as tough as possible.
Yeah.
And you're
two-a-days and
Yeah, the two-a-days and you're doing up downs.
Yeah.
And he's a big guy, he's like 6'10". He was like 300 pounds or something or more. And you know, that was a lot of work to like get his body up down to, you go down to the ground, jump up, you know, you're running in place. Really tough. He lasted like 2 days, 3 days, and
in the Virginia heat.
In Virginia, yeah. Which is not like nice, you know, dry Salt Lake, right? It's super humid. It's super oppressive.
Yep.
Goes down with a heat stroke. Luckily, one of the trainers like cooled him a little bit, so he survived it. But he had, you know, extensive issues, right? And
he's in a coma for 3 days.
Yeah, he was in a coma, and so he comes out of it. He needs surgery, and the university is like, well, you know, you're done playing football.
Right.
He's like, no, I want to play football. And this is a very controversial topic. And so he ends up going to the Corey Stringer Institute. And so they said, okay, we're going to try and bring you back, restore your heat tolerance, right? So you can, again, play football. And he trained for, you know, almost the entire year, kept coming back for this heat test, flunked it. Finally, the third time he passes it, he gets to play again. He ends up better than he was before his heat stroke. He did well enough at the combine that he, you know, was able to participate in the NFL draft. So that's a long journey from being medically retired. And the way he was brought back was by deliberately training in the exact same weather that it almost killed him.
Yeah.
And that blew my mind. Like, wait a minute. Like, the cure is actually the thing that almost killed him. That actually was the story that, like, grabbed me.
Bill Gifford, he's a science writer. He covers health and human performance for publications like Outside Magazine and Wired. His new book is Hotwired: How the Hidden Power of Heat Makes Us Stronger. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the science writer Bill Gifford, whose new book is about heat. And a good bit of this is about saunas and sauna culture, which right now are having a moment. But Gifford says this isn't a new preoccupation. It's much older. It's about how humans have always dealt with heat, how we've adapted to it. He says we're built for it. Heat can kill us, of course. But he also explains how controlled exposure may have real benefits for cardiovascular health, for recovery, how our bodies handle stress, and even, according to some research, a role in treating depression. And Gifford connects that to cultures that have been using heat for hundreds, thousands of years, and why it feels like we may be coming back to it now. His book is called Hotwired. You write about the early days, the early history of how they came to understand thermal regulation, the idea of how our bodies worked. And this great story you tell about the colonial governor of Georgia. He notices these, the indigenous people there were really good at dealing with the crazy heat in the South.
They didn't complain about it.
They didn't say a word about it. They seemed adapted, and he wasn't, and the colonists weren't. And so he got curious. He wrote to the Royal Society asking how humans could handle this. Tell us a little bit about those early days of trying to understand how it worked.
Yeah. So, the colonization of North America was a major marketing challenge, because colonists would come over from England and they'd be like, holy cripes, like this is unbelievably hot. It was like hot and then it was cold too. And they're like, this sucks.
Yeah.
And they'd write letters home complaining. And other people would be like, I'm not going there. It's miserable. And so they had to sort of market it. Anyway, so this governor, whose name was Henry Ellis, he was, supposed to be relatively okay as British colonial governors went. So he had this fancy gadget called a thermometer, which had been invented in like 1715. The Fahrenheit thermometer, it was the height of fashion. Had it dangling from his hat, and he had one in his garden, and he's walking around Savannah, and he looks at it, and it says it's 105 degrees. So he says, wait a minute, how am I alive? Because my temperature is 98, and outside it's 105, so am I being slowly cooked?
Yeah.
Like, what's happening? And so he writes a letter, writes a funny letter to the Royal Society, and finally some scientists actually decide, okay, we're gonna investigate this. It was a guy named Dr. Fordyce, George Fordyce. So he had his servants like heat these rooms up in a rented house to different temperatures, so like 90 degrees. And he starts sweating. Okay, it's pretty hot. And he goes into the next one, but it's still below body temperature, right? He goes into the next one. It's like 110. He suddenly starts sweating buckets. And then he gets into the next one, it's 120, and he's just, he's at his wit's end. So they did some experiments, and they got this room up to like 200 degrees. And then they would take their temperature with like a oral thermometer or press it against their skin. It was – their body temperature stayed the same in these intense environments. And so they this Dr. Fordyce is like, you know, there's some weird – something weird is happening here. The human body has this power to destroy and dissipate and get rid of heat and keep a stable body temperature, which is, you know, it's a really amazing insight because that's one of the key functions of like physiology is to maintain temperature balance so that our bodies work properly. Thermoregulation.
Yeah. So what happens – one of the things you mentioned, we talked about the part that, you know, we'll talk in a moment about how heat can heal you. But let's talk about how it hurts you. Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the book at about 114 degrees Fahrenheit, things, so you put it, literally start to fall apart.
Before that, yeah.
But, before that, yeah.
Yeah, but chemically, what, you know.
What's like, happening? Yeah, how can heat – what does heat do to us? That, like,
so at the really sort of molecular level – Our proteins stop, they unfold, right? So they stop functioning. So the little – I think of them as like little machines in our cells or components of our cells. They just kind of fall apart. Mm-hmm. So it's like if you throw an egg in the pan and the white turns white. Those are the proteins unfolding. And so – but before that happens, you run into sort of issues with – fluid balance and organs dysfunction, cell membranes fall apart, your brain can swell up. That's a big problem. Your intestinal – I mean, this is getting kind of gross, but like your intestinal lining can kind of
– break down.
Yeah. And then you have like a huge reaction based on that, you know, all that stuff.
An immune system reaction,
you say. Yeah, a big immune reaction. That, you know, the combination of those things – can be extremely dangerous. And I did write about some cases of football players who did pass away from heat strokes. But, you know, it's really as dire as that sounds, there's like an easy solution. And that is you throw the person in a tub of ice water.
Yeah.
And then that stops the overheating and it can bring them back. I've seen that happen. I've seen athletes in the throes of heat stroke, you know, runners being thrown into like a Rubbermaid tub. It's a Rubbermaid tub with like 50 gallons of water and a couple bags of ice, and it saves their lives.
I want to ask about there's a cultural element that you write about in the book that's really interesting. You say that one of the most convincing things about this story is the fact that so many different cultures around the world have these rituals using heat.
Yeah.
Will you talk about some of them? I mean, I think what's so interesting is there are so many, and they seem to have the same same recipe. You say there's the same basic recipe.
Yeah. It's interesting. And who knows where these all came from, but multiple cultures around the world have some version of putting people in a hot space, enclosed space with, you know, it's hot. There might be some – you know, heated up rocks because that's a good way to store heat. There might be some steam. And people just go in there to sweat. Like around here, there's the sweat, you know, Native American sweat lodges.
Yeah. In Russia, Japan.
Yeah. Everybody's got their own version of it. Even – and you'd think, okay, is this only in cold climates? But there's – down in Mexico, there is a Temescal. And, you know, the Aztecs – had their form of, you know, I went to in the Mayans, I went to Tikal down in Guatemala, awesome Mayan ruins. First thing you see is the royal steam bath, the ruins of the royal sauna. So even down there. And so it's really interesting that this is something that is common to so many different cultures. You know, the Roman baths, you know, all over Europe, you know, it was like a public health institution, but also like a social institution.
Yeah.
And so these customs have like their ways to get clean, their ways to, you know, connect with people. It's like your social network. And then they would have like a religious, sometimes a religious significance to them.
Was the extremity a part of that?
I think so. I think maybe like it's getting people so hot that they see God, I mean, or feel a little bit high.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, say more about that. The idea of it seems like you're convinced that there is a euphoric effect here going on.
You know, I experienced it. Yeah. You know, once I got past the discomfort, right, of heat and got sort of accustomed to it and started doing these sauna practices regularly. And, you know, I would notice, like, I think somebody called it like sauna drunk. And usually the cold had something to do with it. Hmm. So going back and forth, ping-ponging back and forth was like, woo, you know.
But what is it? It's a you're like in a zone or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you push yourself to an extreme in any other area and, you know, you start to have interesting thoughts, you know. And, you know, the Native Americans, it was very deliberately religious and you're connecting with the ancestors and, you know, you're like in an intense trance-like state.
I want to ask about the evolutionary sort of history of all of this, which you explore in the book. So to kind of keep our proteins from, you know, denaturing and our cell membranes from breaking down, evolution has devised this, some strategies for helping us keep cool. And the way we sweat differently than other creatures.
Right.
And that has given us these advantages. Talk about this part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, we're the only animal that sweats to cool itself.
Yeah.
And this was sort of a deliberate accident of evolution. And there's a scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, a geneticist, Yana Kambarov, who has gone back and teased out what were the exact genes that were involved in having us covered with these eccrine sweat glands.
Yeah.
And like no other animal is that way. And so she found that there was a rapid fire like set of mutations. So natural selection really liked sweating, and suddenly we're covered in sweat glands and no other animal is. And so the sweat glands, by the way, this is a little bit gross, but you know, evolution doesn't just come up with something on its own, right? It takes something and like repurposes it. So a lot of mammals have these same kinds of sweat glands, but in their feet to help with grip or something like that. And these mutations just spread them all over our entire body while also removing our body hair.
Yeah.
So basically when you're sweating, it's like foot sweat.
Wow. And over the course of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years, we developed a system, a very distinct and unique system of sweating that's different.
Yeah, somewhere in between our last common ancestor with the chimpanzee.
Well, and the thing that's so important about that is I guess the reason we developed this adaptation was, as you say, it helped us escape an evolutionary dead end. That is, I guess on one hand, it enabled our early ancestors to forage when it was hot, I guess, right?
Yeah.
I guess that's part
of it. Which is a big deal.
Which is a big deal.
Yeah.
Like everyone else is sleeping.
Yeah.
And we can go off and find food.
We could get the good grubs before.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one. But the other really fascinating part is that it gave us an advantage during hunting.
Yeah.
Which is this hypothesis you mentioned from this great biologist who just retired from the University of Utah, David Carrier. Would you talk about his hunting hypothesis?
Yeah, so he studied sort of locomotion and how various animals, including us, get around. And I think he was thinking about running and why we're kind of good at running. And he kind of came up with this hypothesis that the fact that we could sweat and cool ourselves helped make us like this incredible endurance athlete that we kind of like in terms of like animals on the food chain, like we kind of punched above our weight.
Yeah.
Like, cause if you look at us, we're like you and I are like, we're like a tasty snack for like a saber-toothed tiger.
Yeah.
And we can't run very fast.
No.
And we can't punch it and beat it up. And you know,
we don't have super sharp teeth.
We're in trouble.
Yeah.
And we're probably not much of a hunter either, but then we had this ability to basically endure in hot conditions, which most mammals don't. So if you think about like if you walk your dog on a hot day, the dog is panting and you're not. I can go way farther than the dog. The dog might sprint faster, but you can outlast. And his theory was that we could outlast prey. Not that it's easy, but theoretically you could do that. So that was one explanation, potential explanation for why sweat helped make us so successful.
Let's come back to saunas.
Yeah.
How do you describe the relationship between the fins? Because they seem to be – I think I read somewhere that it was something like 80%+ of fins do regular saunas. Sauna.
Oh.
Do you think that's right?
Oh, yeah. If that may be low.
It's really
– I mean, there are these studies that came out a decade ago. But they had looked at sauna habits and correlating them with cardiovascular health. And they were like, geez, like we don't really have a control group. Can we find some guys who didn't sauna? Yeah. And out of like 2,400 subjects, there's like 12.
Yeah.
There are more saunas than cars.
Such a part of the culture. Yeah. Talk a little bit about what's going on. If what is happening in a sauna? You mentioned in the book that most people think of it as a steamy place. But it's not really steamy, at least not at first. When you add the water to it, it becomes that. But talk a little bit about the experience of a sauna for those who don't know it or aren't familiar with the kind of the cultural part of it and the experience of it.
Yeah. So, there are different different kinds of heat bathing practices. The Norwegians have their version. The Finns have their sort of classic version, and it's really kind of where saunas that custom survived. It's very simple. There will be like simple wooden benches. There will be a heat source where some sort of usually like a wood-burning fire heating up some stones that then radiate heat up the space. It can be like startlingly hot when you go in, and you can pick – the heat is stratified by height. So here's a pro tip. If you're new or you're trying it out, sit on the low bench. So then, okay, you're in there. It's this hot room. It is a dry heat. Weirdly, it's like 15% humidity.
Yeah.
But then when somebody does put the water on the rocks, and it's polite to say like, okay, do you guys mind if I put water on the rocks when you come in? You pour a bit on, steam comes up. And then that changes the whole environment completely. So you have this intense burst of humidity that makes it feel hot. It like there's a lot more heat transfer happening to your skin. So your skin starts to feel a lot hotter. So
you say in the book, it tricks you into thinking you're hotter than you are.
Yeah, your core temperature, if you had the probe, wouldn't be going up that much.
Don't use the probe.
But your skin is – and I think that does something to your mind that I don't completely understand. Taps into that thermoregulatory system as well. And also I think some of the mind-body connection.
Well, you say part of the sauna use, you say, strengthens not only the heart but the immune system and the mind and even the body. And part of that experience, part of the stress that it's – that sort of hormetic stress or whatever that it's putting on the body, part of that's also psychological.
Yeah. And you have that feeling of like wanting to get out.
Yeah.
And that's part of it.
I need to get the hell out of here now.
Yeah.
And that's part of it.
That is part of it. And, I think some of the benefits may travel through that pathway. There's some suggestion that some of the physical health benefits or certainly cardiovascular may be enhanced or even mediated through the sympathetic nervous system kind of withdrawing. So it gets activated, then it gets withdrawn, and then that maybe helps with your blood pressure.
You say a little bit about the studies that are out there, and you talk about also how tricky it is to you know, epidemiological research and what's the causal effect and all of those kinds of things. But what can we say and what do we know about what is actually happening with our cardiovascular health and metabolic health and all of those things? What is Asana doing?
Yeah. So if you're in that hot room and your brain is thinking, wow, it's hot, maybe I should get out. Your body's like, wow, it's hot. You know, let's cool you off. So we're going to crank up heart rate a bit. So you have more blood flow, and we're going to send that blood to the skin to try and offload some heat. And so you get a heart rate benefit. It's like, you know, somewhere around, depending, like a light jog. It's light exercise, right?
Wow. Yeah.
And I think that explains why these studies that we're sort of alluding to have observed a reduction in heart attacks and stroke and all-cause mortality among people who used – in Finland, we use sauna frequently.
Yeah.
So similar to exercise. And then, you know, you start sweating eventually, right? You have more blood whooshing around, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like skin blood flow is like 16 times normal. The blood flow in your fingers goes up like 5 times.
Wow.
So a lot of blood swooshing around your body when you're in a sauna.
Bill Gifford. We're talking about his book, Hotwired, How the Hidden Power of Heat Makes Us Stronger. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's get back now to a conversation with the writer Bill Gifford. We're talking about his new book, Hotwired. You say in the book that the most unexpected thing you learned about heat was its ability to heal. Let me read you something that you write in the book. You write this. You say, for as long as we humans have known fire, we've sought out hot spaces to clean and restore our bodies, to heal from disease, to mingle with others, and to preserve our emotional equilibrium. And I think what's interesting about what you say there is that there are two kinds of healing that you're talking about. We heal our physical bodies, you say, but it's also we heal our emotional wounds or potentially could or have with heat. Say something about that, if you would, because it's also an important part of the book.
I came into this from a very sort of physical biohacker kind of point of view, and how is this going to affect my health and longevity? And it didn't take long to figure out that, like, I also felt better mentally and had some creative thoughts and, you know, felt good. And it turns out that there are actually some researchers looking into what they call whole body hyperthermia as a potential treatment for depression. So that basically entails heating people up, raising their body temperature a couple of degrees, which sounds crazy. But with these severely depressed people, and there are reasons for this, but like it appeared to have a very powerful effect on their depression symptoms, more powerful than SSRI medications, for example.
You say that severely depressed people run hotter for some reason.
Yeah, this was something that had been observed. And then one of the people I interviewed, Ashley Mason from UCSF, had been doing this big study using Oura Ring data and body temperature and then correlated it with depression severity. And the most severely depressed people had a significantly higher body temperature, close to a degree, I think. They also sweat less. And so, you know, it's kind of an out there hypothesis, but
yeah,
it's that there's something wrong with their thermoregulatory system. So being able to sweat and being able to regulate your temperature is kind of a marker of health.
Mm. I want to read something that you write about this experience you had in Colorado. Let me read this as a way to sort of set this up. You said, there's no hope of escape because I'm encased in a green metal cylinder that looks like part of a rocket fuselage but is in fact a personalized infrared sauna. My head's exposed, but the rest of me is tucked inside this tube which is lined with heating elements that are slowly roasting me with 1,000 watts of power. By far the least sauna I've ever experienced, you say. Will you talk about this experience that you had and what you were getting at with this one?
Yeah, this is in the category of things that I did so you don't have to.
Right.
But the idea of the study was, you know, to try this whole body hyperthermia, basically raising people's body temperature a couple of degrees, about 2.5 degrees. Mm.
And they do this on people with depression.
Yeah. The
idea is, you give them a fever, basically.
Yeah, you give them a fever. And, you know, some we think of a fever as being bad, but many smart people in the medical profession have noted that fever also is associated with healing.
Yeah.
So there's something going on. And somebody else noticed that in certain situations, a fever could improve people's moods. Mm. Going through that. So anyway, they tried this in a bunch of studies, a handful of studies, and the finding was repeated. So they were doing a bigger study in Vail, which had an issue with mental health, substance abuse, you know, like resort towns often do suicides. So they're trying this out. And that study's still ongoing, but I participated in that. And it was interesting. It was not a fun experience.
No,
definitely not.
It sounded kind of brutal.
Yeah.
What did it teach you about the larger story, I guess?
You know, full disclosure, I kind of went into it in this sort of journalistic guise, a little bit of like stunt journalism, you know?
Yeah.
But then leading up to it, I was like, well, this sounds actually pretty tough. Do I really want to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And I took one of those depression inventory questionnaires.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't even know it. I'm a little bit kind of depressed. Maybe it was just a bad day or something. I don't know. So, okay, I'll try it. And, you know, it was not fun to go through.
Yeah.
At the end of it, I'm like, I'm not sure I see this working for people. And then the next day, I was driving back from Vail to Salt Lake City. Suddenly, it was like that whole day I felt just kind of good and different. And I don't know if it was because I had just done something really difficult or it was having a more profound effect. But it was the evening of the presidential debate.
the one, that's right.
And I flicked that on. It was like going as badly as it possibly could. It was terrible for, you know, everybody. And I was like, even that doesn't bother me.
You write about there was this, you know, it was summer monsoon season. Clouds were gathering, and usually you get kind of freaked out about that. It's not fun to drive in those kinds of conditions. But even there, you said you felt this is how you describe it, a feeling of pure liquid calm.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt peaceful driving on I-70 with the, you know, 45-mile-an-hour crosswind and tumbleweeds and trucks. Yeah. I was pretty chill. Like it was surprising.
One of the things you write about is that even though it's really natural to want to avoid heat, sometimes it's just good to lean into heat, lean into the heat, you say. And you mention how our ancestors, not our ancient primal ancestors, or maybe, although that's clearly the case, but like your grandparents or your great-grandparents, they would have experienced these big temperature swings during a day.
Yeah.
But now we've, as you say, engineered that out of our daily lives. You write about like air conditioning, for example. We've come to expect this constant, I want it at 70 or whatever it is. And I wondered what you think the implications of that are.
It's sort of like a devil's bargain. Like we do all these things to make our lives more comfortable. And, you know, some of them are good, right? Some of them are why we live longer than our grandparents and previous generations did. But at the same time, you know, like, for example, you know, I could have walked here, but I drove.
Yeah.
And so I deprived myself of 6,000 steps or something.
Yeah.
But I save time. So it's comfort and convenience, and we lose the resilience. So I'm that much less stronger because I didn't walk or ride my bike. Right. And so the heat thing is a little bit the same.
But you say we should learn to, you say we should learn to exercise our sweating machinery.
Yeah. And this is a kind of a theory that is kind of out there. And I think the depression, the heat and depression study was part of that, that by living in this sort of safe, comfortable environment, we miss something that is actually essential for our mental well-being. And I think one way to think of it in terms of the heat is, and also cold, is this idea of interoception. It's basically like your awareness of what's going on inside your body. And a lot of modern life divorces us from being fully aware of our bodies. So we're not really aware of how hungry we actually are. We're driving by Chipotle and we're like, I'm going to stuff a burrito in my face. And even though I'm not really hungry, but it tastes so good, I'm going to eat these Doritos or something. And I think heat is the same way. Huh. And I think the reason people are kind of gravitating towards this contrast idea, the heat and the cold, I think it just makes them feel alive, right? You feel something, right? And if it's 70 degrees all the time, you're not really feeling anything.
Let me ask you finally, after a year and a half of exploring all of this, you say you became heat educated, you became heat adapted, you became heat resistant, all of those things. How did it change your life and your relationship ultimately with heat? Because you say that even your reasons for seeking the heat started to shift your approach to, you know, all of this. How did it change?
Superficially or glibly, you know, I can book a tea time in the afternoon in July.
In July, and go, you'll get the 2 o'clock tea time.
Yeah, yeah. I can handle the 2 o'clock tea time. But, you know, it made me it was good to like step outside of the story I told myself, which is that I didn't do well in hot conditions. And what does that do for me? I think as an athlete, it gave me a comfort level. And I would use a little device as I trained for the Hotter in Hell 100 called a core temperature sensor. Like triathletes use it. It's like $100. It tells you your core temperature. And so I'd be riding on a hot day and, you know, my temp would be like 100.5. And that's like not that hot.
Yeah.
Right. So I was nowhere near a danger zone. I was not I could handle it. I had this ability to I could do more than I thought.
My homeostasis is working.
Yeah, yeah. And that's powerful.
Yeah.
That means you can do more than you think or that you tell yourself. I mean, that's a powerful it's very empowering knowledge. Hmm. That's kind of ultimately where it led. Like, I didn't think I would like or be able to tolerate sauna, and it turns out I was, and it had all these beneficial effects physically and mentally. And then also the heat adaptation piece, that's now a tool that I can use to, you know, enjoy my life, perform better, do things that improve and extend my health, and on and on.
And the social part is so interesting too, because
that's the best part.
Well, that is the best part. It seems like that seems to be your conclusion, because one of these things you say that these researchers would notice through these experiments always was that their study subjects who were being exposed to this heat, they started just out of nowhere talking.
Chatting, yeah.
Yeah.
Including me. I'm a listener, right, normally. And Ashley Mason was like, you were really chatty when we got out of that tube, that hot treatment in Colorado. And yeah, and they didn't – this is one of those things that like it's hard to capture in a peer-reviewed study. And like, how are you going to quantify that? But it's a really interesting observation that the subjects in the original sort of hyperthermia studies would just – really depressed people would start talking. So it seems to like – open some doors, maybe, like open the floodgates. I don't know. It does something. I mean, there's something about sitting, you know, with people in a sauna. It's like sitting next to somebody in a bar. There's an opening for a conversation to happen, right? And so we're seeing this rise of social sauna, which is really interesting to me because this whole interest in it came from the longevity world and data about health and biohacking. And instead, people are kind of going as a social event. So I'll go to the places I go to here, and you'll see like girlfriends and guys groups and couples, and it becomes sort of a bonding exercise, a bonding thing. It's interesting. And they've created little communities around themselves, similar to what I observed in Finland. So that's kind of cool to see.
Americans are becoming like the Finns.
Yeah. We talk a lot more, though. So it's probably good. Yeah.
Bill Gifford, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Bill Gifford. His new book is called Hotwired: How the Hidden Power of Heat Makes Us Stronger. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bobard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.